This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iran's president says his country will return to the full implementation of the 2015 nuclear deal once it verifies that the U.S. has removed all anti-Tehran sanctions. Russia says Ukraine and NATO are continuing military preparations, calling on them to refrain from actions that could lead to escalation. And U.S. President Joe Biden says systemic racism is a stain on America's soul following the conviction of a white ex-officer charged with the murder of George Floyd. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half-hour: the Iranian president says that Tehran will return to full compliance with its obligations once the U.S. removes all sanctions it has imposed on Iran.
The first step is to remove sanctions. This is what the United States has to do. Of course, others, namely the 4+1 group, should also help. But the main responsibility lies with the U.S. It is the U.S. that created this problem, and it should remove all sanctions.
President Rouhani added Iran needs to verify the removal of the sanctions first. He said Iran will then dismantle any activity which may not be in line with the 2015 nuclear deal and fully abide by its commitments. The president reiterated the best way to settle the standoff over the Iran nuclear deal is to fully implement the agreement. Elsewhere in his remarks, Rouhani touched upon the hardships that U.S. sanctions have caused, especially for the country's economy and medical sector. He said the sanctions have hampered and delayed Tehran's efforts to buy coronavirus vaccines. Negotiations to revive the Iran nuclear deal adjourn in Vienna, with plans to restart next week. Iran's leading delegate, Abbas Araghchi, says the sides will focus on the sequence of measures that need to be taken by Iran and the U.S. Homolevsky reports.
Signatories of the Iran nuclear deal end their fifth session in 2 weeks amid efforts to revive the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. Two working groups have been formed, one to draft a list of measures that need to be taken by Iran and another to outline the sanctions that have to be removed by the U.S. Now a third expert group will be working on the matter of sequence. Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, said that would be the focus of talks when they resume next week.
Next week, the most important question is to talk about the sequence, because we have already talked about measures, and we have now focused more on the question of sequence to make sure that the U.S., who has left the JCPOA, should come back first, should lift all its sanctions first, and then Iran would follow after the verification.
Although no direct talks have taken place between Iran and the U.S., the American delegation has been engaged in discussions with the other parties, including Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China.
The top priority remains to focus on sanction lifting. In this particular context, the U.S. must lift all its sanctions, may it concern Iran or any third party, in thorough, complete, and straightforward manner.
Before leaving Vienna for Tehran, Araghchi said Iran does not want to prolong the negotiations, but also needs to take the time to work on every single word that's being drafted to come up with a specific formula allowing both Iran and the U.S. to come back to full compliance. Iran says the talks are on the right track and moving forward, but as the EU coordinator put it, there's still a lot of work to be done. Homolevsky, Vienna.
Russia has called on Ukraine and NATO to refrain from any action that can escalate tensions. Russian media cited the country's foreign ministry as saying that Ukraine and NATO are continuing their military preparations in the region. The comments came one day after the Ukrainian president urged his Russian counterpart to meet him for easing tensions between the two neighbors. In recent weeks, Moscow and Kiev have been trading blames for a spike in violence in the eastern Ukrainian region of Donbas. Their pro-Russian forces and Ukrainian troops have been fighting since 2014. Russia has also deployed thousands of troops to its borders with Ukraine and on Crimea for training exercises. Russia called the deployment a response to NATO's military activities that threaten Moscow. The Kremlin says NATO's involvement in Ukraine has turned the country into a, quote, powder keg.
Tensions between the United States and Russia appear to be ratcheting up in recent weeks over a range of issues, including Ukraine. The Russian Defense Ministry on Tuesday accused the U.S. and NATO of engaging in what it described as provocative activities in the waters and airspace of the Black Sea. Moscow also accused Kiev of trying to destabilize the situation in the eastern Donbas region. Amid escalating tensions, Washington and its NATO allies have rallied behind Kiev. They voiced concern over Russia's troop deployment along its borders with Ukraine, claiming Russia might be planning to invade the country. But Moscow said the military buildup was in response to cold, threatening military action by NATO and nothing more. Washington-Moscow tensions heightened after the U.S. administration announced a new array of anti-Russia sanctions last Thursday. The White House claimed the sanctions were in retaliation for a range of Russia's actions, including its alleged meddling in the U.S. election, cyber espionage, and action in Ukraine. The Kremlin responded with tit-for-tat measures. But the hostile attitude of the U.S. and its allies is not limited to Russia. They have also collectively formed and launched a pressure campaign against China. Just last month, the U.S., along with the European Union, Britain, and Canada, imposed coordinated actions on Beijing under the pretext of human rights violations. The United States and China have also been embroiled in disputes over a host of issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. Beijing has time and again accused Washington of seeking to destabilize mainland China by interfering in the affairs of Hong Kong and Chinese Taipei, as well as fomenting tensions in the South China Sea. The country last week escalated its military activities after the U.S. announced it would deploy its warships to the region. The Chinese president on Tuesday also criticized the hegemonic power structures in the global governance, calling for the rejection of such moves.
The future of the world should be mastered by all countries in the world. Rules made by a single country or just a few countries cannot be forcibly applied on others. The world order cannot be led by unilateralism from some country.
The growing tension between Washington on the one side and Moscow and Beijing on the other is bringing the two countries even closer. U.S. President Joe Biden will probably face a nightmare scenario given deepening ties and strategic cooperation between China and Russia, the countries Washington think is a threat to its global interests.
Other critical aspects.
Last May, a white U.S. police officer from Minnesota knelt on the neck of a black man for over 9 minutes during an arrest that was captured on camera. The 46-year-old handcuffed man George Floyd repeatedly said that he could not breathe before he died. The incident then prompted months of protests against police racism and brutality in the U.S. Now that officer, Derek Chauvin, has been found guilty of murder.
Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer, has been found guilty of the murder of African-American George Floyd.
We, the jury in the above entitled matter, find the defendant guilty. This verdict agreed to this 20th day of April 2021 at 1:45 p.m.
Chauvin was convicted on all three charges against him: second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and manslaughter. The verdict was announced after a three-week trial that had the entire United States on edge. Major figures have now hailed the conviction as a watershed moment, with U.S. President Joe Biden calling the verdict a much-too-rare moment of justice.
It was a murder in the full light of day, and it ripped the blinders off for the whole world to see. The systemic racism is a stain on our nation's soul. This can be a giant step forward in the march toward justice in America. Let's also be clear that such a verdict is also much too rare.
And Floyd's family said they could breathe again.
People from Brazil, from Ghana, from Germany,
Everybody, London, Italy, they're all saying the same thing. We won't be able to breathe until you're able to breathe.
That's right.
Today, we are able to breathe again.
Oh, yeah.
Floyd family's attorney called the moment important, not just for Floyd's legacy, but for the legacy of the United States. Witnesses, friends, civil rights activists, politicians, and the world of sports also weighed in on the jury's decision to convict Chauvin. Many people took to the streets in different U.S. cities to celebrate what they called a stunning historical moment.
This is a stunning moment in history. You know, a white police officer was actually convicted of murdering a black man that we saw on video. And while this is not justice because it won't bring George Floyd back, it is the start of accountability on the part of the police.
However, many say the verdict has been just the first step on a long path. Some say Floyd's death was not captured on camera. The court would not have even convicted Chauvin of the murder.
This is a very powerful, very positive moment, but let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. The system is still the system, and had it not been for the video, in fact, I just published a piece today, George Floyd minus video equals Trayvon Martin.
So without a doubt, the court's ruling is a historic moment in a country where law enforcement officers are rarely found guilty of killing civilians. In the words of Floyd supporters, this has been the first big milestone, but a lot more needs to be done.
The United Nations says the Myanmar junta's crackdown on anti-coup protesters has displaced nearly 250,000 people. UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Myanmar, Tom Andrews, said the world must act immediately to address what he described as this humanitarian catastrophe. Meanwhile, demonstrators have gathered in the southeastern city of Dawei for a night vigil to remember those killed during anti-coup protests. Myanmar has been in turmoil since the army toppled de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi in a coup in February. The military argued that the November election won by Suu Kyi's party was fraudulent. The junta has since intensified crackdown on anti-coup protesters. India's coronavirus outbreak sets new records with nearly 300,000 cases and more than 2,000 deaths in the last 24 hours. India's total infections have now reached 15.6 million. While its death toll is nearing 183,000, the country has seen an unabating increase in coronavirus cases in the past few weeks, reporting over 200,000 infections daily. The capital, New Delhi, imposed a weekly lockdown from Monday, and the virus epicenter, Maharashtra state, tightened restrictions. India is also facing a severe shortage of medical supplies, including oxygen and hospital beds. Prime Minister Narendra Modi has already urged the nation to step up efforts to curb the surge.
I appeal to the young people to form small committees in their societies, their neighborhoods, apartments, to help ensure COVID discipline is followed. If you do this, then governments won't have to make containment zones or enforce curfews and lockdowns. These steps won't be needed.
Modi also described the situation as a big fight against the pandemic, but urged the states to use lockdowns only as last resorts. This is while his government has been criticized for its lax rules that have allowed election rallies and religious gatherings. India is the world's second worst hit nation in terms of infections. After the U.S., it is also the fourth highest death toll worldwide. Leaders of a political party in Pakistan have called off demonstrations in protest at the publication of blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad by French magazine. The decision by Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan came after the party learned that a resolution would be discussed in Parliament on expelling the French ambassador to Islamabad. The TLP has waged an anti-France campaign for months since French President Emmanuel Macron defended a satirical magazine in republishing sacrilegious cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. The protests erupted into violence last week after the TLP leader was arrested over his demand to expel the French ambassador. France has drawn criticism from across the Muslim world over its Islamophobic stance. Our Islamabad correspondent Javed Rana says some Pakistani lawmakers are not in favor of expelling the French ambassador because they don't want to jeopardize their ties with the West.
The TLP, the political party which had organized all these protests, they had an agreement with the government, and government has now decided to implement that agreement. Under that agreement, a resolution would be passed in the parliament, and if parliament approves the resolution, only then the French ambassador could be expelled from Pakistan. Now, everybody knows in Pakistan that for the parliamentarians, it is not that easy to skip the passage of the resolution, because they have to go back to their home and they have to seek vote from the people, and people would not forget that they did not stand for the honor of for the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. So it is a very risky job for the Pakistani MPs not to be part of the passage of the resolution. At the same time, we have also seen that the Pakistan People's Party, one of the mainstream party, has decided to boycott the proceeding. Now, in a way, they don't want to displease West, because, of course, they have good links with the Western countries. They don't want to jeopardize that. And at the same time, they don't want to be seen to be standing with the France on this particular issue.
The Arab League, the United Nations, the European Union, and the African Union have called for an immediate and unconditional withdrawal of all foreign forces and mercenaries from Libya. In a statement, the so-called Libya Quartet rejected external military intervention in Libya as unacceptable. The UN estimates there are around 20,000 foreign troops fighting for warring sides in Libya. According to UN experts, the fighters are from Turkey, Russia, Chad, Sudan, and Syria. The Libya Quartet also demanded full compliance with UN arms embargo on the war-torn country. The embargo came into force in 2011, after former ruler Muammar Gaddafi was toppled in a NATO-led operation. The Chadian Transitional Military Council says it's not seeking to seize power after the country's president died on Monday.
By putting in place a transitional military council, the defense and security forces are not seeking to seize power. We would like to reassure people that the members of the transitional military council will return power back to a civilian government through free and democratic elections within 18 months.
The council's vice president said security forces have taken their responsibilities to defend Chad's territorial integrity and prevent the country from falling into chaos and anarchy. On Tuesday, the military council named Mohamed Idriss Deby president, Deby's son, as interim president. A Chadian rebel group said it rejected a military transition led by the president's son and pledged to march on the capital. Idriss Deby died on Monday during a battle with rebel groups in the country's north. Deby had ruled the country for 30 years. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight. research from NASA has suggested that it is possible for humans to maneuver much faster on the moon than the Apollo astronauts did in their missions between 1969 and 1972. Theoretically, walking the circumference of the moon could be done faster than previously predicted. We have prepared you an article authored by Harry Baker. The piece is titled, How Long Would It Take to Walk Around Moon? The article was published on Life Science website. Please stay with us for more of Harry Baker's article. Be quicker than we originally believed, but it's a logistical nightmare. From our vantage point on Earth, the moon looks small, but if you were to hop in on a spaceship, don a spacesuit, and go on an epic lunar hike, how long would it take to walk all the way around it? The answer depends on myriad factors, including how fast you can walk, how much time every day you spend walking, and what detours you'll need to take to avoid dangerous topography. Such a trip around the moon could take longer than a year, but in reality, there are a lot more challenges to overcome. According to NASA, a total of 12 humans have stepped foot on the lunar surface, all of whom were part of the Apollo missions between 1969 and 1972. The footage that was beamed back to Earth showed how challenging and apparently fun it was to walk, or more accurately bounce, around in the moon's low gravity, which is 1/6 of the Earth's gravity. However, research from NASA has since suggested that it is possible for humans to maneuver much faster on the moon than the Apollo astronauts did. Theoretically, walking the circumference of the moon could be done faster than previously predicted. According to NASA, during the Apollo missions, astronauts bounced around the surface at a casual 1.4 miles per hour or 2.2 kilometers per hour. This slow speed was mainly due to their chunky, pressurized spacesuits that were not designed with mobility in mind. If the moonwalkers had sported sleeker suits, they might have found it a lot easier to move around and, as a result, pick up the pace. In 2014, a NASA study published in the Journal of Experimental Biology tested how fast humans could walk and run in simulated lunar gravity. To do this, the team got 8 participants, 3 of which were astronauts, to use a treadmill on board the DC-9 aircraft, which flew special parabolic trajectories on Earth to simulate gravity on the moon for up to 20 seconds at a time. This experiment revealed that the participants were able to walk to up to 3.1 miles per hour or 5 kilometers per hour before breaking into a run. According to the researcher, this is not only more than double the walking speed managed by the Apollo astronauts, but also fairly close to 4.5 miles per hour or 7.2 kilometers per hour average maximum walking speed on Earth. The participants pulled off these fast speeds because they were able to freely swing their arms, similar to how humans run on Earth. This pendulum motion created a downward force, which partially compensated for a lack of gravity. One of the reasons the Apollo astronauts were so slow on the lunar surface was because they couldn't do this properly due to their chunky spacesuits. At this new hypothetical maximum speed, it will take about 91 days to walk the 6,786 miles or 10,921 kilometers circumference of the moon. For context, it will take around 334 days to walk non-stop, that is, non-stopping, not stopping or sleeping or eating, around the 24,901 mile or 40,075 kilometers circumference of the Earth at this speed, although it is impossible to do so because of the oceans. Obviously, it's not possible to walk non-stop for 91 days, so the actual walk around the moon would take much longer. Walking around the moon also poses a number of different challenges. Aidan Cowley, a scientific advisor at the European Space Agency, ESA, told Live Science, "I think logistically it could be done, but it would be a very strange mission to support. One of the biggest challenges would be carrying supplies such as water, food, and oxygen." Aidan Cowley said, "I don't think you'll be carrying them in your backpack," adding, "because that'll be far too much mass, even if you're at 1/6 the gravity of the Earth." He added, "Therefore, you would need to have a support vehicle with you. This vehicle could also double as shelter." Aidan Cowley noted, "A lot of the agencies are looking into the concept of having a pressurized rover, which can actually support the astronauts when they're doing exploration missions, kind of like portable mini bases," adding, "You could use that to go in at night and resupply and then go back out during the day and walk around again." Moon adventurers would also need a spacesuit with a design that allows for optimal movement. Aidan Cowley said current spacesuits are still not created with excessive locomotion in mind, but some agencies are developing form-fitting suits that will allow for the arm swing necessary to walk properly on the moon. The moon's harsh topography would also make finding a suitable route around it quite tricky, especially with meteor craters that are several miles deep. Aidan Cowley added, "You would really want to go around the craters. It's just too dangerous." It would also have to factor in light and temperature when planning the route. Cowley said, "At the equator of the moon and during daytime, you're looking at temperatures at around 100 degrees centigrade or 212 degrees Fahrenheit," adding, "And then at nighttime, it drops to like minus 180 degrees Celsius or minus 292 degrees Fahrenheit." The lunar cycle also means there are days when there is little or no sunshine, and at least half the journey would have to be done in the dark. Aidan Cowley said providing protection against these extreme temperatures could be possible with specially designed spacesuits and the rover for protection, but the temperatures could also change the state of regolith, a fine gray soil that covers the moon's solid bedrock, and affect how fast you could walk on it. However, radiation could pose an even greater danger. Unlike the Earth, the moon does not have a magnetic field that helps deflect radiation from reaching its surface. Aidan Cowley added, "If there was no major solar activity at the time, then it may not be so bad. But if there was a solar flare or coronal ejection, and you're hit by high levels of radiation, that could make you very, very sick." According to NASA, solar flares and coronal mass ejections both release large amounts of energy and magnetized particles, but differ in the types of particles they emit, the duration of the event, and the way the radiation they produce travels through space. This type of mission would also require a huge amount of endurance training. Because of the demand of exercising in low gravity on your muscles and cardiovascular system, Aidan Cowley added, "You'd have to send an astronaut with ultra-marathon level fitness to do it." He said even then, walking at a top speed would be possible only for around 3 to 4 hours a day. So if a person walked at 3.1 miles per hour or 5 kilometers per hour for 4 hours a day, then it would take an estimated 547 days, or nearly 1.5 years, to walk the moon's circumference, assuming your route isn't too disrupted by craters and you can deal with the temperature changes and radiation. Aidan Cowley added, "However, humans won't have the technology or equipment to accomplish such a feat until at least the late 2030s or early 2040s. He concluded by saying, "You'd never get an agency to support anything like this, but if some crazy billionaire wants to try it, maybe they can pull it off."
the debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Tensions have been simmering between the U.S. and Russia. U.S. ambassador to Russia will return home for discussions with the Biden administration over the recent escalation. Now, last week, Washington imposed sanctions on Moscow over alleged meddling in the 2020 U.S. election and what Washington is calling severe human rights abuses in Crimea. In retaliation, the Kremlin sanctioned 8 senior U.S. officials. Washington is also at loggerheads with Beijing over such issues as the Chinese Taipei, Hong Kong, and South China Sea, among other things. Xi Jinping is speaking of a novel world governance system that's devoid of hegemony and unilateralism. So where's the world heading for? A new world order? What's that supposed to look like? Stay tuned for a debate on those topics.
Tensions between the United States and Russia appear to be ratcheting up in recent weeks over a range of issues, including Ukraine. The Russian Defense Ministry on Tuesday accused the U.S. and NATO of engaging in what it described as provocative activities in the waters and airspace of the Black Sea. Moscow also accused Kiev of trying to destabilize the situation in the eastern Donbass region. Amid escalating tensions, Washington and its NATO allies have rallied behind Kiev. They voiced concern over Russia's troop deployment along its borders with Ukraine, claiming Russia might be planning to invade the country. But Moscow said the military buildup was in response to cold, threatening military action by NATO and nothing more. Washington-Moscow tensions heightened after the U.S. administration announced a new array of anti-Russia sanctions last Thursday. The White House claimed the sanctions were in retaliation for a range of Russia's actions, including its alleged meddling in the U.S. election, cyber espionage, and action in Ukraine. The Kremlin responded with tit-for-tat measures. But the hostile attitude of the U.S. and its allies is not limited to Russia. They have also collectively formed and launched a pressure campaign against China. Just last month, the U.S., along with the European Union, Britain, and Canada, imposed coordinated actions on Beijing under the pretext of human rights violations. The United States and China have also been embroiled in dispute over a host of issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. Beijing has time and again accused Washington of seeking to destabilize mainland China by interfering in the affairs of Hong Kong and Chinese Taipei, as well as fomenting tensions in the South China Sea. The country last week escalated its military activities after the U.S. announced it would deploy its warships to the region. The Chinese president on Tuesday also criticized the hegemonic power structures in the global governance, calling for the rejection of such moves.
The future of the world should be mastered by all countries in the world. Rules made by a single country or just a few countries cannot be forcibly applied on others. The world order cannot be led by unilateralism from some country.
The growing tension between Washington on the one side and Moscow and Beijing on the other is bringing the two countries even closer. U.S. President Joe Biden will probably face a nightmare scenario given deepening ties and strategic cooperation between China and Russia, the countries Washington think is a threat to its global interests.
Now let me invite our guests to this debate tonight. We'll have journalist and political commentator Don DeBar from New York. Also the senior analyst with Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, will also be joining us from New York. Thank you both gentlemen to the show. Starting with Don, Washington has been at odds with China over a plethora of issues, you know, including trade, Hong Kong, Taiwan, the South China Sea, and so on. And China has kept warning the U.S. against poking its nose into Beijing's domestic issues. How would you foresee things to develop?
Well, to develop from here, let's take a look at where we are. The history of United States relations with China, you know, you look back to the colonial period, the U.S. jockeying for its share of China's pie, and down to the revolution in 1949, and the task one being to undo that revolution, backing the fantasy I was at in Beijing.
Okay, it looks like we have some problem, a technical problem. Let me go to the other guest, to Ian Williams, also in New York. Ian, the U.S. is also having issues with Russia over eastern Ukraine. alleged interference in the 2020 presidential election and hacking government agencies. The two have been trading barbs and also taking tit-for-tat measures against one another. Where is this going to end up in?
Globally, it's a very difficult problem because it's a three-sided problem. Isaac Newton, when he calculated the laws of gravity and the movement of the planets, threw up his hands when it came to trying to plot three bodies together. the math is too complicated. And Russia and China don't have a bloc. Their common interest is making sure that the US doesn't win over on either of them. The interests are completely separate. I mean, Russia is not an economic power. Russia is Saudi Arabia with nuclear weapons and inherited military technology from its greater days. It's not a serious threat to the US, but it's a serious threat in the vicinity. We should remember, both of them are talking about hegemonic influencers and non-interference. The problem in Eastern Donbass is it's filled with Russian soldiers. That's the problem in Eastern Donbass. The problem in Crimea is that Russia occupied it. There may well be a case they could make, but they didn't make it in the international tribunals. They occupied territory illegally, which is the major no-no of the United Nations and the world order, a rules-based world order, which they're hypocritically talking about. Now, the U.S. is hypocritical. The U.S. has done all of these things as well. But you don't go preaching that back at people as though you're covered. China has broken an international agreement. It's arrested people, charged them with subversion for trying to uphold the international agreement that was made between China and Britain about the future of Hong Kong. Once again, that agreement was based upon one nation, two systems, which was supposed to be the model to seduce the Taiwanese into joining them. Now, the Chinese have messed that up completely. They've shown that they were only kidding. So the Taiwanese love to think, well, any agreement we make with Beijing is going to be thrown out the door right away. So, you know, there is room on both sides. Donald Trump wasn't at all interested in human rights. He left the Uyghurs to swing. He didn't care about Hong Kong. He was interested in the trade deal and the money. That's all he did. Mm. And we're getting serious here about the nature of the world and how it's changing. I mean, the Russians, they can threaten equivalent sanctions. What are they going to do? Refuse to let the Americans use the ruble for trade? They're not in a position to. China is different. And if China wants to carry on incrementally advancing the case for a non-dollar settlement of international affairs, it will be doing good for the whole world in removing U.S. hegemony over the world finance. But once again, it's a separate issue. A lot of what the U.S. is doing with China is about the trade. It's about also the fact that the U.S. just does not understand China. It's assuming that the only way that they can succeed is to have a neoliberal capitalist economy. And the Chinese have shown, as many other people in the past have shown, that in fact you can have a government-directed, government-shepherded economy and be extremely successful. The Chinese are an extreme case of what the Asians, the Asian tigers have done over the years. The government has actively directed and interfered in the economy in the interests of stability and social equilibrium. Mm-hmm. The Americans just do not get that in their neoliberal phase at all. They can't understand that any industry in China is going to be directed by the state.
Okay.
Indirectly, or to some measure. And they will have social aims, which include full employment in creating the economy. Whereas the U.S., the corporations can look after themselves. Mm-hmm. People, ordinary people can look after themselves.
Okay.
They're completely different systems, and the U.S. Leadership don't understand that.
Okay, Ian, speaking about China, now in the midst of all these differences between the two, the Chinese president is calling for an end to unilateralism and global hegemony. So it seems that China has already taken steps in that direction too, don't you agree? I mean, warming ties with Russia, the Belt and Road Initiative, etc.
Well, it's up to a point, but the Belt and Road Initiative is a massive one, but that's getting kicked back as well. There's a lot of people on the way are thinking, maybe this isn't such a free bargain as it looked, you know, as the Chinese companies take over ports, and they in a sense, they substituted Western imperialism for Han imperialism from China, it seems to a lot of them. Sometimes the Chinese agreements are just overwhelmingly generous, but there's often a sting in the tail. It's a bait. There's bait and there's a hook in there as well. Mm-hmm. So the Chinese end up with a massive amount of infrastructure, and they're building a new world order. And by the way, this is legitimate. It's what the Americans and the British did beforehand. They built in the same way, but the Chinese weren't strong enough to complain at the time. Now it's they are doing what the British and the others did, and the Chinese did before that, the Americans did before them. And this is one of the problems. If you look at the last two world wars, there were out powers declining in competition with incoming rising powers, whether it was Imperial Germany, Nazi Germany, Imperial Japan. There were countries that felt that they'd been locked out because the spoils had been taken by their predecessors. That's what those wars were really about. And now that's the position. The Chinese and to some extent the Russians getting some degree of resurgence from the real depths that they sunk into after Yeltsin had dismembered their economies and dismembered their power. They want their place back in the sun, and other people have taken them since then, and they're all looking. Ukraine doesn't want to be part of the Soviet Union. I wish they did. I mean, I'm in favor of international unions, but it's quite clear that Ukraine does not want to, and the Russians have not really begun on a hearts and minds thing about it, sending divisions and tanks to occupy it and shooting down airliners and poisoning dissidents is not the way to win hearts and minds globally. So neither of these countries is really doing their best on this.
Okay. Now let's go back to Dan DeBar. Dan, looks like we've managed to fix that technical hitch, hopefully. So sorry for that interruption. Go ahead with your comments.
Yeah, well, I was not exactly fixed what we're going to use the telephone. First of all, what I'm hearing essentially, Scott's talk point is coming from the other guest. There's Russia is not an antagonist here. The United States engineered a coup d'etat on Russia's border. Half the population of that country on Russia's border are Russians. One of Russia's primary military bases in water or in that territory. These are all well known to the United States and their objectives of U.S. foreign policy. John Sullivan, U.S., who came from Rumsfeld and Trump and all of them, also was very busy in the Obama administration. He's a part of the consensus in Washington that has since 1917 decided that the oil and gas and natural resources of Russia belong to U.S. oil companies. And he's been one of the lawyers and lobbyists and other people that sought to do that for their clients for many years and then came into the government, obviously, to facilitate that policy further. What he represents now, with Trump's face having been imposed on his earlier actions and his being able to be an honest broker with the last, on part of the last regime, is a more realistic approach to trying to exploit Russia, which is without starting a nuclear war first. Whereas the Biden administration, like the Obama administration, like the earlier administrations, including Clinton, seem to think that the way to get what they want out of Russia is to threaten it with war. And we find ourselves in a situation like we were when Trump took office from Obama, with U.S. troops up against Russia's borders again, their attempt by U.S. CIA and others to create chaos inside Russia and its allies, like you see happening again in Belarus, to try to pressure those regimes to make concessions to hand over the country's wealth to the West. That's essentially what we see going on. Putin's mood and poisoning this one because Time magazine said so, et cetera, is all sideshow.
All right. John, what about the fact that China and Russia also getting closer to each other, and they have a joint rival or adversary, if you will, whatever? Now, some observers argue that the growing ties between China and Russia could prove to be a nightmare scenario that could challenge Joe Biden's leadership to a great degree. Do you share that view? Don, are you with us?
Okay. Yeah. let's see. First, as far as Biden's leadership, Biden is occupying a chair. There are people that bring him things to sign and put words in front of him to mouth in front of TV cameras and such. He is not making policy. The policy made him. And so let's keep things, you know, oriented. Right, put them on their head. The United States created a condition where Russia and China have essentially no choice but to be strategic partners, regardless of what the individual ambitions might be of people in the elites of either country, to be the other, and Asia, which is rising as the global center. Generally, regardless of that, they realize that the United States, having its military resources bumping up against Russian air defenses in Eastern Europe and China's air defenses in the South China Sea, and playing footsie with the naval exercises and everything else, installing THAADs in Korea, et cetera, they understand that no matter which one the U.S. comes for first, they're coming for the other one next. And so they realized they have to be strategic partners, and that lesson was taught to them by the United States, particularly the Obama administration, which pivoted to Asia and started aggressively against both of them. They were challenging China on the seas of the South China Sea at the same time that they pushed the revolution in Ukraine, and they had a whole bunch of other installs of anti-missile missiles in Romania and other places. Both of those countries could see what's coming, and so they are now strategic allies by necessity.
Okay. Ian Williams, we have only 1 minute. If you could tell me briefly, in which direction is the world moving? Are we supposed to have a new world order?
It's moving towards more instability. I'd like to make a point that the newly assertive China is claiming huge tracts of the South China Sea that every other country in the area disputes. And that China refuses to put that to an international tribunal. It's behaving in the same hegemonic way it accuses the United States of. It's threatening to invade Taiwan. It has refused to say, we are not going to take military action. If the Taiwanese want us, we'll come. If they don't, we won't. And I should say, by the way, that goes against history, because Chairman Mao told Edgar Snow in the Red Star over China that the first thing after the Second World War was that Formosa, Taiwan, would have an act of self-determination, because he was a bit more principled than the current leaders. But we go on. In Russia, Russia is occupying Crimea. It occupied Crimea in defiance of the United Nations and the international community that has about the admissibility of acquiring military of territory by military force. It's gone and poisoned people in other countries, so much for respecting hegemony. It's poisoned a known dissident, and it's not a myth. You've actually got recordings of the people who did it confessing to it. I mean, Putin is wandering around there, and some people, like our colleague, seem to think that he's a some type of progressive revolutionary.
Yeah,
when
I have to jump in. I'm sorry.
He's a hegemonic bully.
All the time that we have, I'm sorry for interrupting you. I want to thank our guests. So we had journalist and political commentator Don DeBar out of New York, and also senior analyst with Foreign Policy and Focus Ian Williams from New York with their comments. And that's it for this debate show. I've been your host, Behruz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I
Faisal Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. I did say that it's divided into different parts. Part one, which alhamdulillah we have now finished, explaining and sharing some valuable points about it, was in regards to how one deals with himself, with herself, our relationship with ourselves. In our lives that we have, how do we cater to our own needs and requirements? Entering into part two is how do we deal with other fellow human beings, our relationship with other human beings. When we're talking about kin and family and rahim, and we are discussing the, you know, difficulties that we do come across with dealing with our fellow relatives, our family members, the dramas that we have, you know, and I understand that we shouldn't be naive and say, oh, well, no, we all need to be good with each other, and that's what the case is going to be, and doesn't matter what someone does to somebody else, you know, we're going to forgive and forget, and Islam says this, and it's not that easy. I understand that, and no one is being naive. Most certainly our religion is not being naive as well, but what is the whole purpose of jihad and overcoming our shaitani side and suppressing our anger and following in the footsteps of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, when it does come to something as simple as respecting our family members and making sure that we don't allow any kind of drifting apart between family members for the sake of a greater good. That I think is the easiest thing that we are able to accomplish if we were to stay away from our greed or stay away from our own kind of personal pride and ego, you know. In many cases, we need to just bite our lip and realize that, you know, maybe sometimes I could have chosen a better approach. Maybe I could have done something different. Maybe I'm wrong and he's right. You know, maybe they could have done something better, but maybe they don't know any better. So I should be the better person. Whatever the case may be, it's always going to need us to go back to the asl, go back to the principle. And the Islamic principle is observe your ties with your kin. The Islamic basis, the Islamic foundation is that we always remember that the priority that we have is to stick to what it is that we believe in our Islamic and moral principles.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book مفاتی ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح الجنان است چه فلان دماد وسعت داره فلان رضوان است.
One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اون اینه که فلان درختکاری رو کم ثواب داره. دعا هم داره، ثواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته بودم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree.
محیط زیست نگه سالم نگه داره این دقیق ثواب داره.
There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخوای کشاورزی کنی یه قدر گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون این هم همون امام گفته دیگه.
When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned.
تو نظام اسلامی این جلد دوم جاش خالی.
We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Muslim societies have always emphasized very much on family and on family values and family ties. Unfortunately, we can see that this is gradually fading away in this individualistic society and everyone being very focused on themselves and centralized and on their requirements and their needs and seeing others to be obstacles in their lives and others, if we could say, interfering in their lives and things like that. So people don't really care what an uncle or auntie or even a parent says, you know, let alone a relative. So it really is devastating. And when we read all of these verses in the Holy Quran and when we read these ahadith from Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, it shouldn't come as a shock or a surprise that one of the ways of us leading to our own self-destruction, moral and spiritual self-destruction, is by not observing kin, by not remembering our commitment to our family members. And that's going to just be the beginning of our moral and spiritual plight, which is very, very dangerous. So we need to revisit all of these things and we need to say, well, you know, seeing that this is the case, then this is what I should do. In today's episode, what I would like to share is the importance of, as you remember, I mentioned that, you know, we have those who are going to be closer to us in kin and those who are going to be a little bit further in kin. And the closest to us in kin is our own parents. Our own parents are the closest people that we have. And this is where that difficulty comes out. So you probably, in your mind, you'll probably be able to justify, you know, not observing kin with your cousin, your relative, distant or close, but how are we able to justify cutting ties with our own parents, with our mother, with our father? How are we able to justify disobeying our parents, our mother or our father, at whatever age we may be? You know, that commitment and loyalty of birrul walidain,